It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Hope you're enjoying your night, your Wednesday night. Well, could a newspaper in Chicago be responsible for the Great Migration? Or how about giving voice to a civil rights movement? Or electing the first African-American mayor here in town? Well, of course, I'm talking about The Defender, the Chicago-based black-owned newspaper. There's a new book out from a former Defender reporter, Eitan McKaylee. He's the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. The book is getting great reviews, and Eitan is my guest tonight. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
It is. I mean, it's amazing to think about all the different historical events, and that's really kind of how you write this book. I mean, the idea of all these huge, significant events in American history and how The Defender played a role in pretty much all of it.
The Defender was there right from the very beginning of the city. I mean, Robert Abbott, the founder of The Defender, got his inspiration for the paper at the 1893 World's Fair. That's really the beginning of the modern Chicago that we know today.
So he came up, tell us about Robert Abbott, because he came up from the South and he came to Chicago to see Frederick Douglass speak.
Yeah, Robert Abbott had a unique background. His parents were both emancipated slaves, but his father, his biological father, died even before he was 1 year old. His mother was a woman with great intellectual ability and a real ambition, and she worked for a newspaper in Savannah, where the family was located. While there, she met a man with a very interesting background who was half German and half African. And he had been born in the United States but reared in Germany and came back after the Civil War, where he identified himself as an African-American. He was light enough to pass, as they said, okay, as they may say. But he identified as African-American, married Robert Abbott's mother, and then did something even more remarkable, which is adopt the young Robert Abbott, who was a short, dark-complected child who might have been held back for both of those things, and, of course, for being African-American in the South,
right,
most of all. But because the Reverend Sengstack, as he became a Congregationalist minister, really gave Robert Abbott a great self-confidence that allowed him to go on and do just amazing things.
Yeah, and it's amazing to think about, because, you know, he comes to Chicago, he goes to the fair, as you said, and he realizes that there's an opportunity here, that it's a couple years later, but an opportunity to put together a black newspaper, because there really isn't any voice for blacks in the South or anywhere in the United States.
Well, this is also a moment where newspapers are dramatically changing. Newspapers until that time had been something like an artisanal process, like a boutique kind of enterprise. They were expensive and they were difficult to produce, such that there were only small quantities of a particular paper available at any particular time. Right as Robert Abbott came to Chicago, newspapers shifted technologically using things called linotype machines, really a kind of a typewriter. And that allowed Robert Abbott to essentially bring a bunch of handwritten pages to a printer and for a relatively low price produce a bunch of issues which could then be sold at 2 cents a copy.
Right.
I should go back just a moment and say that he was inspired to do all this because at that World's Fair, where he was a singer with the Hampton Quartet, he was the Hampton Quartet. If you know Hampton University, which is still today one of the most important historically black colleges and universities in the United States, Hampton back then was really the premier African-American higher educational institution. Booker T. Washington had graduated just a few years earlier than Robert Abbott. And the Hampton Quartet was a fundraising vehicle. This is a time before amplified music, before recorded music. So as the quartet went around the country singing African-American spirituals, they were immensely popular. And because of Hampton's intellectual reputation, Robert Abbott had special access to the so-called White City at the World's Fair. And it was just this amazing atmosphere. Of course, the World's Fair has been talked about many times, but the African-American side of what happened at the World's Fair has rarely been told.
Yeah, talk about that, because that was something that, you know, we know a lot about the World's Fair and the history of that, but you know, it was 1893, so Things were not, integrated in any form. Talk a little bit about the fair.
So Frederick Douglass, the escaped slave, abolitionist, friend of Abraham Lincoln, and a civil rights activist who had become known as the Sage of Anacostia because he lived in Anacostia later in life. He was 75 years old, and he is the ambassador. He was a former ambassador to the nation of Haiti. So the nation of Haiti requested that he oversee their pavilion at the World's Fair. Well, Frederick Douglass used this as an opportunity to gather together a new generation of African-American activists and to inculcate them with the civil rights struggle. So people like James Weldon Johnson, Paul Lawrence Dunbar, Ida B. Wells, Oscar DePriest, who would go on to be mm-hmm. the first African-American alderman in Chicago and the first African-American.
So he brought them all together.
They were all there, and Robert Abbott was there as a young man kind of experiencing all this. And it also has to be said, you got to imagine, there are Sioux warriors who are part of Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show. There are people from West Africa, Eskimos from the Arctic Circle, Inuits from the Arctic Circle who are called Eskimo. At the World's Fair, along with Irish and German and Japanese and Brazilian, and all of them after 5 o'clock are just hanging out together, and it's got to have been the greatest party ever.
Are you just? I've known you for a while, but yeah. And it's amazing to think that. I mean, this project. I mean, you're a history buff. You like this stuff. I mean, this just has to be great for you to be able to write this book and to collect all this information about something that happened so long ago.
Well, and, you know, I worked at the Defender from 1991 to 1996. And when I walked in the door, radio listeners can't tell, but I'm a white guy, white Jewish graduate of the University of Chicago. I didn't know anything about the Defender when I walked in the door. Literally nothing.
And you were like, yeah, you talk about like it's a black-owned newspaper. So so what?
Sure, I was raised in the post-racial era. So to me, you know, an African American owner was the same as right. as a white owner. It didn't seem to make a difference. When I got to the newspaper is when I started really what became a re-education process. And I started to not just understand what was going on in Chicago, not just understand the history of the Defender, but really get an understanding of race in America.
Well, let's talk. I'm going to take a break real quick. When we come back, we'll talk more with Eitan McKaley, who's the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. Got to talk Great Migration because it's – I mean, we were just talking with Danny Davis was on Monday talking about coming up from Arkansas. He's on the other side of the river. And
that's right.
And really the Defender found its first sort of quote-unquote circulation in the South. And it was sort of like, hey, I want to go to Chicago. It's, the Defender's there. Like, it almost like brought people to
– It did.
And it's amazing to think about that this newspaper, this small sort of niche newspaper, was able to start something that historically changed America forever.
Well, Robert Abbott got this vision of doing something for the masses while he was at the World's Fair. Frederick Douglass was telling these young African-American activists that they have to – turn the tide of what was happening in the United States at that time. Of course, African Americans after the Civil War could vote, could participate in politics, got themselves elected to Congress, got elected to local offices as well, could prosper in business. And the white oligarchs of the South really hated that.
All right, we'll talk more about this when we come back here on The Download. Stay with us. Yeah, it's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, Eitan McKaley. He's the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. Eitan worked at The Defender as a reporter from 1991 to 1996. I loved your passage about questioning Bill Clinton at the Robert Taylor Homes.
Yeah,
that's good. That's interesting. But it's the book is really – and it's getting great reviews, and you're everywhere. I mean, it's great to see. And it really does – take this like turn where pretty much every big moment in American history, especially as it pertains to African Americans, the Defender has a hand in it. And you know, we talked right before the break about the Great Migration, and that's when African Americans from the South came up from Mississippi to Chicago and really developed this city that we know. And that was because the paper was being circulated to people in Mississippi, Alabama, the South, and And they were getting an idea that Chicago was a friendly place to come.
Yes. Robert Abbott enlisted the help of the Pullman porters, among others. And when I say the Pullman porters, these were the workers on trains who worked in dining cars, right, who worked in the sleeper cars as well. And on an individual basis. So the porters would come to the defender's office, which at first was in Robert Abbott's landlady's dining room.
And where all good newspapers start.
Exactly, you know, on a dining room table. And the porters would bring newspapers from around the country and go through the papers with Abbott to find articles that could be rewritten for an African-American audience. So this was a kind of wire service back in those days.
Yeah, right.
Also, these porters were learning how to write for newspapers. They were learning how to participate in the production process and really working with Abbott, you know, in that grassroots way. When they would go back out on the trains, they would take bundles of newspapers with them and subscription forms, and then they would sell subscriptions to folks around the country. Now, this has to be underscored for a moment, that hardworking small farmers and sharecroppers and small businessmen in the South earned their dollars with a lot of hard work.
Right.
They did not part with that money easily, and it took a lot to convince them to take out subscriptions to a newspaper in faraway Chicago.
Absolutely.
It was only because of the...
It's almost unheard of.
Unprecedented, yeah, for sure. And Abbott really believed that this needed to be a mass communications vehicle for the national African-American community. So he came up with all sorts of different devices to try to attract them to the paper, mainly with content such as really strong anti-lynching articles that could be read nowhere else in the South, articles that encouraged African-Americans to participate in politics. All that said, Abbott did not initially support the movement of African-Americans from the South to the North because the unions in Chicago discriminated against African-Americans. Robert Abbott knew that himself as a Hampton-trained printer.
I was going to say, the Pullman porters, a great example of that.
That's right. So Abbott said, there's no point in coming here if there's no job for you and there's no way for you to earn a living. What changed was World War I. The number of European immigrants to the United States dropped precipitously. Some even went back to Europe to fight in the respective armies of their homeland. And the demand for American products surged. So the only available labor source in the country was the African-American community in the South, which is, of course, at that point, 90% of the African-American community still lived in the South. At that point, Robert Abbott still did not support the migration.
He didn't. No.
Because it was really just an economic opportunity for folks. And frankly, there were economic opportunities in the South as well. You could go to Birmingham, you could go to Atlanta, you could go to other cities where factories were opening up and needed workers as well. What changed was when Robert Abbott saw that when African Americans left, it hurt the economy of the Jim Crow South. The South...
When it became political.
That's right.
Right.
When he saw that, for example, stevedores left en masse from the Jacksonville, Florida port and caused all sorts of problems because there was just no one to do this skilled labor, that's when he started to get the idea that this is a tool to strike back.
It's fascinating, too, because it really... You know, politics plays a big part. You know, when the African-American population moved to Chicago, created a tremendous sort of, I guess you'd say, voting bloc, you know. And let's talk about that, because the Sendak family and Abbott and everybody, they were political. I mean, they're political. And I believe in the book, they're Republican.
They are Republicans. Well, in the first half of the 20th century, African-Americans are almost all Republicans. That's the party of Lincoln. The Republican Party, it's sometimes hard to see that today, but was founded to end slavery. And African-Americans were extremely loyal to the party. And it should also be said that the Democratic Party was the party of Southern segregationists. It was dominated by the South up through Franklin Roosevelt's time, so it was not a attractive opportunity for African-Americans. African-Americans who went to Democratic national conventions were actually enclosed behind chicken wire most of the early part of the 20th century.
So let's talk about what made what was the transition politically from Republican Party to Democrat Party. I mean, when did that happen? And Chicago played a big role in it.
It did. Well, Chicago, by 1919, Carl Sandburg, the great Carl Sandburg, visiting the African-American community in Chicago, rates it as the strongest political unit in the United States. Not the strongest African-American political unit in the United States, but the strongest political unit,
wow,
period.
And that's a big number. There's a big number. I forgot the 50,000, something 50, 000, like that.
Yeah.
And the thought was that if you could convince that block to vote, you would see a sway in the vote.
Well,
they weren't necessarily loyal to one party or other at this point.
Well, they were especially loyal to the Republican Party, but they were most loyal to those that reached out to the African American community, and anybody who made a sincere effort to reach out to the African American community, Democrat or Republican, had a shot at getting those 50,000 votes, which could elect a congressman, mm-hmm, a mayor, a governor, and in many cases a president as well, by swinging Illinois into one column or the other.
That's so amazing. So what was the impetus to change loyalties?
So by 1928, Al Smith is the Democratic,
yeah,
nominee. This is the beginning of the ascendancy of the northern branch of the Democratic Party. The defender shifts in favor of Al Smith, mainly because at that point it is so disgusted with the Republican Party, which at that point is trying to explicitly become a, quote, Lily White party. This was something that was really anathema to the African-American electorate. And so Robert Abbott, to protest this, swung his support to Al Smith, at least rhetorically.
Right.
At that same election, they were also electing Oscar DePriest, the first African-American congressman from the South, from the North. So they wanted to support DePriest, who was a Republican, so they soft-pedaled their support at the top of the ticket.
That's fascinating. It's fascinating to look back, especially at that time, and how, you know, from essentially the 1920s, 1930s, the African-American vote is pretty much largely swung to Democrat only.
A lot of it really has to be attributed to FDR. FDR wasn't just political in the way that he reached out to the African-American community. He was sincere about it. This is a time when white people were generally not wanting to be photographed with African-Americans, didn't want to have any physical contact with African-Americans. And FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, are constantly with African-Americans, are embracing African-Americans, are shaking hands in a manly way with African-Americans. This alone communicates very strongly that FDR is different from other politicians.
Well, okay, let's take a break, hit the news with Rob. But when we come back, we got to talk civil rights. And I want to spend a little bit of time on Harold Washington, because the defender at that time, with Jane Byrne, with Mayor Byrne and Richie Daley, like, there's some really great sort of politics back and forth from the chapter on Harold Washington. We're talking with Eitan McKaylee. He's the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. We'll have more of this conversation after the news here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Got a great show tonight. Coming up in the second half of the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to talk with Mike Fouché about the CPS bankruptcy brouhaha. Which is all, I mean, I guess, if the mayor is down and out, there's blood in the water, why not attack? I think that's what we're seeing here. I'm not sure that this is a real proposal. I think it's just to put a black eye on the mayor, and we'll talk more with Mike about that coming up after 8:30. Also in the 9 o'clock hour, we'll talk to Collaboration. We'll talk to the drinking and writing guys, Sean Benjamin and Steve Mosqueda. They're from the Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind crew, and they have been doing drinking and writing for years now in the Haymarket Theater behind Haymarket in the West Loop. And then coming up at 10 o'clock, Character Flaws, brand new segment. This is just going to be where we do comedy bits. That's it.
That's great.
My guest, we continue our conversation with Eitan McKaylee. He's the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. A really great addition to the already great documented works about Chicago history. But this is one that, you know, I've known about the Defender, and I feel like being in the media, I've known that paper and I've read that paper. But there's so much that I think the regular Chicagoan just doesn't know about the history of this, what really is now a niche weekly. And a lot of it is modern history, man. The Civil Rights Movement, Chicago Freedom Movement, the Defender was right there.
The Defender was Martin Luther King's journalistic guardian for the first few years, really, of the Civil Rights Movement. It started writing about King 2 weeks after the Montgomery bus boycott mm-hmm. began. And within a month or two had already recognized Martin Luther King as a new kind of leader and a very significant kind of leader. They really liked it that he was from the South, that he was a minister, and that he was young and forthright.
And this was done through a series of articles, but really the editorials. I mean, the Defender was much more than just a newspaper that was covering Black America. There was an editorial section, and it was almost a live and die by editorial section.
Absolutely. As with every other American newspaper, there's a firewall between the newsroom and advertising and editorial. But at the Defender, it really was – the editorial section was absolutely critical because – it had it was a newspaper that always punched so far above its weight. It had the ability to really influence people with those editorials. Vote for this candidate. Don't vote for this other candidate. These kind of things were really significant in terms of shifting the electorate because people really trusted the Defender.
And it was seen by politicians, a lot of white politicians and people in power, that of a mouthpiece for the Black community.
Absolutely. If you wanted that crucial support from the African-American community, you had to go to the Defender. Even as the Defender started to kind of lose its national circulation and kind of become more of a local force, let's say by the 60s, 70s, local politicians knew that they absolutely had to get into the Defender and also into the Bud Billiken Parade, which takes place every summer, which
yeah,
most people don't know the Defender sponsored and created back in 1920.
It's a character,
yeah.
Right. The Civil Rights part, and I hate to skip over because it's such a big part, and you can read the book, but the Chicago Freedom Movement, 68 riots, all the kind of stuff that you know, put Chicago in the news and the national news, the Defender was in the middle of. But, you know, keeping going with the politicians, I want to take time to talk about the election in 1983, the Harold Washington running for mayor of Chicago and the Defender's role in that election, because he was running against an incumbent in Jane Byrne and Mayor Daley's son, who now is the second Daley, I guess.
There was second
the
retired.
Daley. Yeah, right. Yeah. But the idea being that the Defender played a role in this election.
The Defender was really a voice of conscience in what was the most racially polarized election in the city's history. The Defender, by staying somewhat above the fray, in the sense that it wasn't hysterical. The white newspapers were somewhat hysterical about the potential of Harold Washington becoming mayor. They thought that he wasn't qualified. They didn't like the fact that he had a very minor criminal record. They didn't pay attention, frankly, to his record in Congress or his record as a state senator. They didn't really give that much attention to Harold Washington as an intellectual either.
In general, they just didn't pay much attention to him.
Yeah. Well, with one exception, it has to be said that David Axelrod,
right,
the columnist for the Tribune, was the sole voice in any of the white-owned newspapers that really understood what was going on and was telling everybody to pay attention.
You write about it in the book, yeah. And there's you quote one of his columns. It was so interesting about the idea of, you know, people, you know, sort of pushing back at this sort of "it's our turn." You know, and that was the Harold Washington sort of moniker or you know, slogan. It's our turn, right? And it was amazing to think about. He's like, well, yeah, it is. Because essentially the way he wrote it was, he's like, yeah, it is because, you know, every time there's an African-American, they say, you got to play inside the system. Well, they are.
That's exactly
right. And it's time
right.
to win, right?
That's exactly right. And, of course, we're coming off of years in which there were riots almost every summer in Chicago, where you had confrontations between large groups of young people and the police department. Places were destroyed. Arson happened in a lot of locations. there was a lot of tension over these issues. So it was something that the defender was trying to tell people that this is not Harold Washington's agenda. He is not going to destroy the city. He is going to take the city in a positive direction. He's going to actually try to dismantle the machine. That's really what Harold Washington was determined to do. He was a product of the machine who had come to realize that it was harming not just African Americans, but everybody.
It's amazing, too, because really where the defender played the biggest role was when Mayor Byrne said, I'm not going to talk to you guys. Essentially, was it like it made a huge, maybe a misstep in that campaign where she just ignored the defender.
Well, she ignored the defender, but her surrogates tried to offer the defender various enticements to endorse her. The defender exposed those offers and said that we are not that kind of newspaper and we are not going to do anything but expose these kind of shenanigans. And they looked at that as a further mark against Jane Byrne, who, of course, had had an erratic career as mayor and had won initially with very strong support from the African-American community, but had really gone the other way very soon into her
reign. Well, she had done the sleeping at Cabrini Green. She had done a lot of stunts. She didn't seem to be very open and welcoming to the African-American community in her own cabinet and things like that. And so it did seem like it was time, but that seemed like a slight on Mayor Byrne's part that ultimately came and bit her in the butt.
Yeah, and listen, I think all of it would not have – the defender would have endorsed
any candidate
that was qualified. They looked at Harold Washington objectively. They said, here is a guy with a long political track record. Here is a guy with – record of decisions and opinions and statements that we can actually review. And when we deduct race as a factor, we see that he's just very simply the most qualified, the most honorable, and the most motivated of the candidates.
We're talking about the defender here on the download. You know, we only have a couple minutes left, Eitan. And I wanted to ask about now, because the defender, you know, over the years, there have been more stories about its management and its sale and the ownership of this, you know, historic paper than the work that it's producing. Talk about it, because it's seen better days. It's now back to a weekly. It's been a weekly for a while.
Sure.
And it doesn't have the power it once had.
It's true. And of course, what's happened to the defender is what's happened to newspapers all over the country. The internet makes it possible to deliver news immediately. And it also makes it possible for people to communicate with each other in a way that doesn't require the page of the newspaper to do that. Classified ads or articles of hometown news. These are all things that are now done on Twitter or Facebook. So the defender lost a lot of its circulation the way that all newspapers are. But I have to tell you that as I started to think of closing this book, I had to say to myself, am I going to predict that the newspaper is going to go away? And I had to come to the conclusion that I don't think it will. I think that as long as there are issues that the defender needs to defend, the defender will be around. And the folks that are running it today, are doing a great job. They're like we were back in the 90s. They don't have enough resources. They don't have really what they need to do everything that they would like to do. But they love the paper, love the mission of the paper, and are going to do everything they can to get the news out.
You know, last question just about writing this book and you know, putting your time and energy into defining the history of the defender. I read this somewhere in one of the pieces that you did, just about this isn't necessarily a triumphant look at you know, race and Chicago and politics. No. Looking back through this as a historical piece, you see it's hard to celebrate.
I came away from this book understanding that there had been change, but not necessarily progress. That was really the kind of sad conclusion that yeah, we have an African American president. Yes, there are opportunities that were never there for African Americans. But if you're a kid growing up in Englewood today, your situation may even be worse today than it was a generation earlier, for kids a generation earlier.
Eitan Michaeli is a reporter. He worked at The Defender in the 90s, 91 to 96. He's the author of The Defender, How the Legendary Black Newspaper Changed America. It's a must-read for Chicago history buffs. Eitan, thanks for coming in and sharing your story tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.